Well, that'll take the place of our weekly Bob Dylan segment here on Dave's Gone By, playing a little bit of Lay, 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 the Melanie version, because we do have on the phone and safe and sound. Sorry that we lost her a couple of minutes ago, but we have her.
Right.
We are secure.
I've
with
been lost a lot.
Well, from the 60s. Do you remember the 60s, or are you one of those people? It's
well,
a blur.
I remember the 60s, sorry. Of course, you know, people's recollection of things changes according to your state, you know, your state of being. But I was probably the only person at Woodstock that wasn't stoned.
Is there a reason that you did not become part of the drug culture?
I guess I was in my own little universe. I was very introverted, and I was so focused on, you know, like getting up on that stage and being, you know, really communicating what I needed to say and everything that I was afraid that if I, you know, had like a creative leak with some kind of drug, that it might taint the message. So I was a purist, you know, and I was all into health food, and I was a vegetarian, and you know, so I was at that other end. There were lots of other people like that, you know. I mean, the take on mm-hmm. sex, drugs, and rock and roll, that was definitely a media thing that happened, and it almost happened immediately after the fact, because during that time it was very open to all kinds of new ideas, and there were lots of people who didn't, you know, think drugs were the way. But of course the whole, you know, media take and everything you heard about it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but it was about ideals.
Now that it's literally 40 years past Woodstock, what was it like for you, who was really part of that, especially not so much the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but the spirituality of what the whole culture was trying to do back then? Was it depressing to watch the 1970s happen, and little by little the hippies became, you know, Reaganites?
I was kind of in denial, basically. I didn't believe that it could go back to such a dark age so quickly. But I underestimated media power, and that's what the agenda was, and that's what happened. It just went poof, you know. And I didn't see. I always believed in humanity as a power and a force to change the world, and I still do.
Wow.
I didn't become cynical. You know, certainly I became aware and wondered, but I didn't change my idea about people. I still believe that people will rise to the occasion and do it.
So if people were looking at you now, are you live in Arizona at this point, or Nashville?
I'm in Arizona. I really live in Nashville. But my husband of 45 years and my friend and my partner, he produced every CD that you hear, all the recordings, he died suddenly. We were on the road. And I just can't face going back to Nashville. So my son and I just continue to do the gigs that he booked. He also did all the business, and we're like two idiots here. we our last gig was in Arizona, and that's what we did. We did it, and we're staying. We're guests of some wonderful people, and I'm staying here until I figure out what I'm doing.
Wow. I mean, I wasn't going to get into this until later in the conversation, but what is it like losing your life partner, your husband, of 45 years? And also, it was your work partner, too. It wasn't just like the husband who went away and then worked all day.
No,
and, yeah.
I mean, we were, grief is an odd thing. Like, right now, I'm just talking as if I'm talking about, you know, something that happened to somebody else. But it comes in these waves, and sometimes it's just, I mean, it's devastating, and I can't function. So, and I never know when it's going to hit. Like last night, some people said, do you want to go to the movies? And I haven't been to a movie since. And, you know, we always went to the movies, you know, and I just broke down and nobody could figure out what it was, you know. But it was about, it was that, it hit me. All of a sudden, I'm not going to go to the movies with Peter. You know, we're not going to talk about what happened at the movies and what we thought of the movie and laugh at the places we shouldn't, you know, and make jokes and about, you know, some absurdity or something. I mean, it's just, my son and I, of course, have a friendship and a camaraderie. We were always together, the three of us. We were, my son was a creator, and we're like a team of artists, you know, and just one of our soldiers is missing, you know, and so we're, I can't even explain. It's so impossible when a person that you were that close to is gone that I don't even believe it's true, that life cannot possibly just go away. And I do feel him, and when I feel him the most is when I'm on stage. I sense he's there.
I mean, it's just, we should also mention that this is a relatively raw thing. I mean, he passed in, was it November or December, just this...
I'm just really going through, I have to keep singing, I have to keep creating, it's where I really live, you know, in this creative place. When I'm on stage, I'm okay. And when I'm talking to people about what I do, I'm okay. It's all that time in between.
And can I ask, when you're creating and when you're maybe writing new songs or just, or is it a way, are you able then to escape, or as a creative artist who's affected by everything around you, do you suddenly find yourself only thinking about, you know, writing songs and thinking of what he would say, or songs about your life together, and then it just becomes too painful to even do that, to be in the creative mode?
No, I haven't written anything about that, and I don't even know if I ever will. I mean, when I had children, I thought, oh, I'm going to write all these songs about motherhood, and I don't think I wrote one. No. I might have written a semi-lullaby, but I don't know how that will emerge in the songwriting. You just never know where that's going to hit.
And I should mention, you know, you talked about your son, I think his name is Bo, and he accompanies you, he plays the guitar, but you did not mention someone that I'm very grateful to, the woman who helped me get this interview with you, a woman by the name of Layla Heyman, who is also a performer, and you know her pretty well, I assume.
Yeah, she's my daughter, and she's kind of stepped into dad's shoes. She's been the person who's connecting me with the rest of the world right now, because, as I said, I'm just kind of a recluse. Arizona in a desert, and that's why our reception has been so bad. But it's just so completely removed from our reality together when Peter and I and Bo were together, that we're just in this kind of a limbo, and it's making it bearable. So that's why I'm staying here. It's removed from anything we've been involved with.
If it gets kind of too painful to remember stuff, then we can go elsewhere with this. But I am curious again how you met Peter Shekarik, and was he at Buddha Records already? And then
No. He was an independent producer who had just gotten hired by these music publishers, Hugo and Luigi, who were quite successful. They had produced Elvis, and they had produced some big names in the industry and written songs. They wrote songs for Elvis Presley, and I walked into their office by mistake. I thought I was going for an acting audition, and it turned out I was I'm in a music publishing office, and the two men, Hugo and Luigi, walked in while I was hysterically looking for the right office. They thought, because I was there with a guitar, because the character that I was going to play was Barbara Allen in a play called Dark of the Moon, and they thought I was there to audition. They told the secretary, oh, set her up for Thursday. And they walked on through, and I'm looking at them like, set her up with what? What's a music publisher? I didn't even know.
But you hadn't written any songs at that point.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you had?
Yeah, I had written many songs, but I didn't really think a person could do that. You know, I didn't... in fact, when I first started out, my first recording happened, they didn't really know what to call me. So they called me the female Bob Dylan.
There were 4 million male Bob Dylan.
Yeah, well. That I should be on your show at this particular moment. Because I was the female Bob Dylan for a good 10 years, that this is the female Bob Dylan. So I always wondered if they called Dylan the male Meltney.
Well, you know, they called every rising folk singer for 20 years the next Bob Dylan, whether it was Loudon Wainwright III, John Prine, you know.
The next.
At least you got to be the first female Bob Dylan, you know, before Tracy Chapman came along or you know, Suzanne Vega or whatever. But
they already had singer-songwriter, so they didn't have to worry about that anymore. Then you were safely a female singer-songwriter. But they didn't have that term then.
Right. And Hugo and Luigi, that was the old school. That was songs were written for other artists to cover. So were they looking at you as a songwriter at that point?
Yes.
Wow.
So they were interested in my songs, and I sang to them, and they looked at me like, oh, my God, this woman could never happen. You know, I could feel it. You know, they were looking across from their Louis XIV desks. I mean, I went into this inner chamber of their office with gilt chandeliers and leather upholstered chairs and big antiques. And I was in this other world, you know, of luxurious appointments, and they listened to me sing, and they were interested in the songs, but I could tell that there was something very peculiar about me because of the way they looked at each other. But they were interested enough to say, well, we just hired Peter Shakarik to be the head of our production company because we're producing a Broadway show, so we'll have you come in and sing your songs to him. So I did, and he just was the first person who reacted that way. I mean, it was this, he heard something, he saw something that nobody else had seen or heard, and he decided from that moment that he was going to produce me, he was going to marry me. I didn't know he had made these decisions.
Well, I'm curious, how long between... a kind of a business thing. How long between your walking in and him looking at you as a writer, performer, and you looking at him as a producer, between that and you're looking at him as like, oh, potential boyfriend life partner?
Yeah. Well, it happened within days.
Okay.
So it was that vast, and it was forever.
And that was already after you had like a single or two on Columbia Records.
No. I had nothing.
Oh, wow.
I had never made a record in my life.
Wow.
No, he was the very first producer who ever worked with me.
Do you remember what the songs were that you first played for either Hugo and Luigi or Peter Shekarek?
I played everything I had written so far, and I don't even think I had written. Yeah, I did. I had written Beautiful People, so Beautiful People was one of the songs I sang. But I wrote other songs that never did get on a recording, and I wrote a song called God's Only Daughter, and I sang that, and I sang Birthday of the Sun, and which is a song I sang at Woodstock, and I still can't figure out why. But it was, you know, and of all of my whole set, I think that's me. They used a bit of that in the Woodstock 2 movie. So that was...
It's funny you bring that...
People
sorry.
Come, you know, who are, like, I call them born-again hippies. You know, they're young kids who just saw the movie, and they'll ask me to sing that song, which is something that it was just like this song that I wrote and never sang again.
Well, let me... Because I'm in sort of this weird... Woodstocky mode. A couple of weeks ago on the program, we had Elliot Tiber, who takes some of the credit for making sure that Woodstock happened. He was the one who said, "Hey, do Max Yazger's farm," because the other farm was like, "We're not going to let the people in here." And he wrote these. I'm reading the books now. I interviewed him before I got to read his books, and they're really, really great. He wrote "Taking Woodstock," of course, and "Over the
Elliot Hunt." Tiber wrote "Taking Woodstock."
Yeah, it's his story.
Oh, my God.
Why?
No, that's very funny, because I remained in contact with him for a few years, and I never realized that that was his story.
That was him. He was this kid in running this horrible hotel of his parents up in White Lake, New York, or wherever it was. And
right.
Just having this miserable
wow.
time. Yeah. And it's a marvelous book.
Listen, give me his phone number because I need to talk to him.
You bet. I'll off the air. I'll give it to you, or you know, I can email it to you if you want. Or I'd be happy to, but I can't give it right now. But I will, certainly. It's great hearing his story and just this thing of like, well, you think it's a 3-day concert. People showed up and jammed the roads like the day before, but they were camping out a month earlier. It was insane up there. What was your Woodstock experience, Melanie?
Well, I mine was sheer terror. I certainly didn't run into Elliot then. I did have one beautiful moment with Joan Baez. I'm not her personally, but I developed over the day this terrible demonic cough.
Oh.
That just from being nervous, and that it was just deeper and deeper, and it louder and louder. And so Joan Baez sent over an assistant, and
oh, wait, I missed that. I'm sorry that your line got crunchy.
Joan thought you might need this, and she sent her assistant the party. And I thought that was such a beautiful thing because I was suffering in my little lower echelon dirt floor tent. And she was in the upper echelon bigger tent. I just made that up. I don't know if it was lower echelon or they just figured they needed more artist space. But I was in this little tent. I know Tim Harden was one across from me. And... when I got there, Richie Havens was singing for dear life. and every once in a while they'd come up because I guess they liked having the acoustic people going in between the big band setups, you know.
So that makes sense.
Setting up the big groups with, you know, two drummers and sax players and everything.
Sure.
And, they have someone like me, you know, just filling in kind of in between, or Richie, or Tim Harden, or Ravi Shankar, or, you know, the people who didn't have such a setup. So right. Every once in a while, they'd come over and say, "You're on next." And I get all, oh my God. And then they said, no, never mind. You know? And this happened all day long.
Oh, God.
So by the time somebody has heard me coughing, it must have been pretty frightening.
But you got up on that stage, and did you do like 40 minutes? How long how long were you up on the Woodstock stage? Do you remember, like half an hour?
A half hour. Yeah.
Wow. Any other memories of that weekend? That day? I mean, were you flown in and out on a helicopter? I mean, how did you?
Yeah, my mother drove me up there because Peter, of all things, we were working on a. On a film tour in England.
Uh-huh. Melanie, your phone, are you still there? Your phone line is really getting... Are you there? Can you hear me? Melanie? Oh, no.
Yeah, do you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Yes. It's just your phone is getting really, really, like, all scratchy. I thought this would be better than a cell phone, but it's not.
Oh, God. Maybe I should... this is a landline. I don't know.
Never trust a hippie with machinery. Yeah, no, you sound fine. You sound good. So continue, please. So you were saying.
Yeah, so what was I saying?
No, I have to roll it back. It was something about getting it. Well, your mom drove you up to.
Yes. Yeah. My mother drove me to Woodstock because we were working on film score in England.
Mm-hmm.
And that was big deal stuff. You know, I wasn't a known performer in any way, but people were starting to notice my writing, and so I was asked to do this movie with Olivia Hussey, who had just done Romeo and Juliet, and Tom Bell, and Judy Carn.
Oh my God!
This is a big thing, and the London Philharmonic was playing, you know, doing the orchestrations of things, and so this is really big. So Peter stayed in England, and I was really debating whether I should go to this festival, which I really thought was like a picnic on somebody's farm, and I was picturing people with blankets and, you know, like a family outing, you know, people would come and there would be arts and crafts, and it was going to be a nice little weekend, you know, and I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't go, but Peter said, oh, no, you should really be there. I think it's going to be really great.
Well, he was right in the long run.
He said, I'll stay here with the London Philharmonic and you go home. And my mom drove me up to Woodstock, and we hit some traffic. Now, again, I don't know what planet we were on, but we didn't sort of get what was happening, you know? So I certainly didn't.
Yeah.
And nobody really believed that it could possibly be traffic happening that far away from a place.
Uh-huh.
Wait. Concerts.
Uh-huh.
You know, a show. So I made a call, and they said, oh, no, don't go. Go to this place. And so I called, you know, no cell phones.
Of course.
You know, a whole way, different way of finding things out, and no emails and no texting. And so I, you know, found out it was at a different hotel, and it was, so I went there, and as soon as I got there, I knew something was really up, because there were the media trucks, and in the lobby of the hotel, there was Janis Joplin surrounded by cameras and slugging her Southern Comfort and being interviewed, and Janis Joplin was a superstar, you know, at that point, even, and I just wasn't, you know, I had never sung before more than 500 people in my life. And then there was Sly Stone, and I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? What is this? And so then some guy comes over and says, okay, get on the helicopter. And I said, a helicopter? What helicopter? I'd never been on a helicopter. And so I'm running with my mother's holding my guitar, and we're running for the helicopter, and I start to get in, and my mother's behind me, and some guy says, who's she? I said, that's my mother. And he said, oh, no, Mom, sorry. It has to be managers or the band. I didn't even have the street smarts to say, oh, yeah, she's my bass player. You know?
And so, wait.
But or my manager or something. But so I said, goodbye, Mom.
Oh,
and
no.
That's it.
What'd she end up doing? She just got stuck there.
Oh, my mother, and it's, I don't even have my mother here to ask her what happened.
No, but how did she end up spending the weekend? I mean, how did she get home?
Well, I personally don't remember getting home, but I think she made it in eventually.
Oh, wow.
And I guess we drove back home together, but I have no recollection of anything that happened afterward except that I got calls from every television station channel to talk about Woodstock and the social significance of this event, and I was on panel discussion shows with anthropologists, you know, talking about what this was, because it certainly wasn't a concert.
Do you think it was socially significant in the long run, or was it the tail wagging the dog, or the dog wagging the tail as far as Woodstock Nation and what that meant for the hippie culture?
Oh, no, I think it was a symbolic culmination of all of the ideals that were being flung down. And, of course, you know, that's also where manipulators reared their heads, because this is a group of people that could be swayed, you know? Because if you take some of what they say and make it apply to what some of what you say, they could be pretty valuable, this group of people. And it was seriously meddled with, let's just say that.
Now, you continue on after Woodstock for a very long time in the music business. You're still in it. You've seen the changes of what's happened in the selling and the performing of music. I mean, what are your thoughts about record companies and that whole scene in the 70s and 80s and now?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
It's pretty sad. I mean, I myself I don't have any rights to anything that I've ever written, sung, or performed. It's owned by the corporate entities, and I get nothing from any of it. In fact, Taking Woodstock had minutes of my song being sung by me, Beautiful People, and I'm sure Elliot doesn't know this, but I got nada.
That, because it all, even as a performer, the money all went...
Performer. As a performer, the rights are owned by the people who bought the master, and as a writer, my writer's share was lost or stolen, you know, somehow in the wording of contracts, in things that say writer's shares and writer's royalties. There's a very fine line and a big difference, and I don't own anything.
There's actually a commercial out recently using Brand New Key, and
I got nothing.
So really, your living is performing then. When you go out and you do concerts and stuff, is that your bread and butter?
That's it so far. And, I'm writing. You know, I continue to write, and hopefully I'll write the next Brand New Key. I'll laugh at all of that. But at this moment, actually, I do have a new CD. I got to get it to you. It's called Ever Since You Never Heard of Me. And I thought that's the perfect title, because there are so many people who do know who I am, but there are so many people who have the vaguest idea. But they will, if you sing a song of mine, say, oh, yeah, I know that, or I've heard that, or, oh, that was that commercial, or this was this commercial, because they've really used my songs in a lot of things and in a lot of movies. There was also just recently a movie called Jackass where they put my song, and that, again, didn't even say hello or give me movie tickets, you know.
What song did they use in Jackass?
brand new key.
Oh, okay. That meant, yeah. Well, it's a bouncy little. We played it earlier. Yeah.
And they used it in what was that movie? It was.
What? Sorry.
Mark
Wahlberg?
Porn movie about the porn star.
Oh, Boogie Nights. Boogie Nights.
Yeah, Boogie Nights, right.
Well, but I guess, as you say, you were able at least to...
But that isn't all. The music industry has changed that. Lawyers became the A&R men.
Right.
And basically, they replaced people who knew music. So, the general public...
Melanie, hold on one sec. Are you like jiggling the phone cord? It's really, really going in and out here. Let's try this again.
You want to call me again? Maybe you'll just...
No, let's keep going because we've only got like 7 minutes left in the program.
Well, listen.
Yeah.
The industry has changed in that people don't have music appreciation anymore in the schools. So... Mm. There's the old dumbing of America thing, you know. In Europe, people do know what a bassoon sounds like, and they do know what a concerto is, and they know who composed what, and they have general music appreciation. And in schools now, we just don't. We don't have a well-rounded musical. When I was a kid in school, I learned who composed. Humoresque, it was not much, but it was something. Yeah. It was people did know what a nice bit of music was, and now it's just totally missing from schools, unless they're private elitist type schools. But most public education is just missing music appreciation and art appreciation. And I think that in itself is one of the most dangerous things about the music industry, because if people don't know what a song is, then they can sell them things that they're passing off as music, but it actually isn't.
It's funny, I should hook you up not just with Elliot Tiber, but I know, you know, obviously the actress Carol Channing. She's been on a jag of making sure there's art education and appreciation in schools, and she
really
has a whole foundation.
I would really, definitely, because in fact, my husband and I were working on the International Singer-Songwriters Hall of Fame.
Uh-huh.
We wanted to bring music appreciation out there. We wanted to have libraries where you could go online and listen to different kinds of music and have it broken down by the artist who liked that particular bit of music and would talk about it. Everything, you know, whether it was a bit of pop music or country or folk or classical. But, you know, that's really missing. And I would really champion that cause.
Can I ask you, Melanie?
One other thing that's very important is marketing. People don't realize how malleable they are as groups. That marketing used to be the study of what groups liked what kind of music or what kind of products. And now marketing is more a complete market, like your product. And that's where I think it's kind of dangerous.
We're sort of they're shaping the in almost a fascist kind of a way.
Of course.
Let me ask, what is the music that you listen to? I don't know if you have an iPod or if you're still in CDs or what. But what do you listen to on a given day or week?
Oh gosh, you know, because my son is composing and we're mostly listening to what we're creating. I suppose. I've never been, you know, a person who sat and listened to trends or anything.
Well, I'm sorry, I missed that. I didn't hear that. What did you say?
I'm not a person who, you know, sits and listens to the current trend of what's going on now. But I just, you know, whatever passes through my somebody will say, oh, you have to hear this or that. And, I mean, it goes from everything to classical, quite a bit of classical. Vaughan Williams is one of my favorite composers and orchestrators, people, and I mean, we listen to everything.
And was there a particular performer, musician, or songwriter who influenced you way back when, in the early 60s?
Yeah. Well, again, Joan Baez was my hero, but I tried to sound like her, but my voice was way too gravelly. And I was very influenced by, my mother was a jazz singer.
Oh.
And I grew up listening to Billie Holiday and Bessie Smith. And
I hear that. I see. Yeah, I can actually, I get that. I do get that from your music.
Yeah,
I can hear it.
It's like people say, where did you get your style? I said, I guess it was out to, I was out to imitate Joan Baez and Billie Holiday, and I got it wrong.
Well, no, you obviously got quite a lot right. I mean, you had a very, we just have a couple of minutes or a minute or two really left, but I'm wondering, like, the great, aside from Woodstock, the great highlights of your career, be it meeting idols of yours or just wonderful moments performing somewhere, just whatever comes to your mind.
Well, Woodstock, of course, the Isle of Wight, which was the, I guess, the over-there version of Woodstock, was as amazing, and also Glastonbury, which was verged on mystical and magical, and in fact, I'm talking to them this year about doing it again.
Ooh, cool.
Glastonbury Festival. Now it's a very big thing. I think this year they have Beyonce.
All right,
which is kind of funny. I mean, because then it was all, you know, very beautific, and people wore these beautiful clothes. In England, they always really... they dramatize an era. You know, if it's punk, they have the highest mohawks. You know, if it's hippie, then they have the most flowing robes and garments, and whatever the style is. If it was punk, or they really do it up. You know, so that Glastonbury Festival I felt like I was back in Avalon, you know. And it really was very, very beautiful, and they romanticized everything. So it was really something magical. And I got up on stage with, everybody had these big bands, and there I was, just me and my guitar, and the people just, it was magical, absolutely magical. It was filmed somewhere. There's a film of me at Glastonbury in 1970 or something.
For people who, as Melanie says, you know, there's whole generations who may not know who she is, at least we do have YouTube. You can go there. There's dozens of her clips.
Well, thank God for that, because it's like, that sort of kept me... kept me visible in some areas anyway. But again, if you don't have a PR company constantly putting your name, I mean, that's the other thing. They have the short tail and the long tail now. If you don't have, it used to be you could be on one big television show, you know, and everybody in the country would know who you were.
Right.
But that time is totally gone. I could be on... you know, any of the big shows, and then next day they won't know who I am. You know, you have to follow that through. And it's amazing how people, you know, think that you're, it's
yeah.
generated from talent or you in some way. But it totally is, it's marketing and PR, and you have to have it all lined up with the magazine article, and then an appearance on Oprah, and then another appearance on a late night show, and then magazine articles, and then parties that you have to attend and have your picture flashed, and newspaper articles, and it's a connect the dots thing. You know, if you don't have that going on, people don't know that you exist.
Well, on the level that you had it, of that sort of near superstardom level. But to be fair, especially over the past 10 years or so, that model has changed for lots of people who were on major labels.
And I'm not talking about the masses and masses. I am talking about the masses, but as far as niches, yes, people are definitely. I mean, everybody I know wouldn't ever watch primetime television or listen to alternative radio, whatever that's called, you know, because it's all programmed by Clear Channel. I don't know if you're involved with Clear Channel or not.
No, I wouldn't mind, but no, I'm certainly not.
But, no, I mean, it's all being programmed by, you know, Intelligence Central somewhere, and that's what we're getting. That's what people are getting, the masses and masses. And the same with, you know, primetime television, and it's right up there with heavy-duty behavioral modification, I mean, to me. But to a lot of people, they don't even consider going to mainstream outlets for their music or their art or their entertainment.
Let me ask one final question of Melanie, who I'm, first of all, thrilled that you've taken the time to be with us here in the neighborhood. I want to direct people, of course, to MelanieMusic.com. So that's where they can also keep tabs on the music that you're making.
My website is there, and I'm having somebody update it, but my web guy just resigned.
Oh.
So I'm defunct right now, but it's still there. It just doesn't, it's not got a whole lot of activity on it. It does have my upcoming concerts. And where are you located anyway?
Well, this is the University of Northern Colorado in Greeley, Colorado. Actually, that's perfect timing because it's 1:04 in the afternoon, and I have to do like an ID here.
Right.
So,
well, listen, get me out to Colorado. Why don't we sponsor a show of Melanie?
Well, I'll talk to the radio station because we're actually doing our first concert here, putting together local bands on April 14th. I should have probably mentioned this before on the show. Thanks for reminding me. But I got a bunch of bands on Turner Green on April 14th. So we're doing that, and maybe we'll end up sponsoring more concerts as it comes.
You know, I don't know why, but I haven't done a lot in this part of the country, calling Arizona part of the country that you're in. But to me, it's all that, you know, that middle part, you know, that I always blew over. I don't know why exactly, but that's what happened.
That vague area of wheat and sky. Yeah. Well, I mean, it would be wonderful to have you. And I do want to remind folks that you're going to be playing at Joe's Pub in New York. That's one of the reasons we wanted to get you on the air here. I think it's April 22nd, is it?
Yes,
good.
Kings.
Well, I'm sorry, not Joe's Pub. Oh, I'm so sorry. And I made this mistake when I emailed the PR person, too. That was real embarrassing. It's B.B. King's Blues Club.
Yeah, B.B. King's New York City. I've done it a couple of times. It's a great show. If you're all in New York, come out and see me.
Definitely do. And buy her new CD. What is the new CD called?
Ever Since You Never Heard of Me.
And is that available on your website?
I think they're selling one that isn't mastered online, I'm afraid. Somebody got a hold of it and said my husband made a deal with him verbally. And so he got it on iTunes and everything, and I'm in the midst of trying to stop him. I mean, it's bad enough I don't own any of my old songs, but now this other person is trying to take the new one. So I'm, but I do sell them at shows, and
good.
You can download it. It's a download thing, and that's the real mastered one, because what they're selling isn't even a master.
You know, I've never interviewed her, but you should get together with Amy Mann sometime and trade war stories of yeah. of record labels, I'll tell you. Melanie, last question, because I've really got to go. But I'm automatically inviting you back. So by all means, you know, in a little while, let's definitely have you back on with a different telephone and more questions for you, if you don't mind.
With a better telephone line.
That'd be great. But let me ask a quick question about religion, because you've been through a couple of, you know, there was, I think you were in the Meher Baba turf for a while, and then moved into still some Eastern religion. Where are you with that now, and is that helping you during the tough period that you're going through right now?
Yeah, well, I've always been a spiritual person in that I believed that we are eternal beings, and that is usually the thread that runs through all religion. Is that it? You know, we're not just these bodies with, you know, animal people. You know, we're eternal, and the spirit and what we're supposed to be is not exactly what is, but there is the possibilities. And right now, I'm just chanting. Mm. I am chanting because it gets me through. Because I go through, as I said, these times that are so unbearable that I can't breathe. So I'm just chanting, Nam Myoho Renge Kyo.
Well, no, whatever works, man. Whatever works.
Right? So that's what I'm doing.
Well, we'll all do
get
some.
Me through.
We'll all chant for you and wish you well and to get over. I mean, you know, time, it does take time. You shouldn't be getting over it immediately. It will be tough for a very long time. But keep making the music and keep being creative and keep having that great spirit that you have maintained from the very beginning, and just keep it going. And thank you so much for gracing us with your presence in the neighborhood.
Aw, thank you.